Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Writing a book is hard. Getting it published is the next hurdle. The publishing landscape can be especially rocky terrain for new authors, self-published writers, and the legions who are not household names. Add to that a publishing world that is changing and consolidating, giving rise to author scams that promise book deals, movie tie-ins, and more, for a fee. Earlier this year, the Justice Department charged three people behind a company called Page Turner with defrauding more than 800 authors out of $44 million. Brent Crane is an investigative reporter who wrote an article for Bloomberg Businessweek titled, "Our Goal is to Get Their Money, Inside a Firm Charged with Scamming Writers for Millions." Welcome to All Sides, Brent.
Good morning.
So your lengthy article talks about the multi-billion dollar self-publishing industry and how the term self-publishing is kind of a misnomer. So what is self-publishing and why is it a misnomer?
It's a misnomer because, you know, a lot of it involves other people, actually. So there are these companies that offer a bunch of services to so-called self-published writers who can pay them to have their book marketed, to have it literally printed and edited and things like this.
Mm. So you're not at, when you're self-publishing, there's other people involved and you have to pay money and it's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, there are avenues to truly self-publish, but a lot of people tend to use these companies.
So you're writing about different people in your story, one of them being Kevin Dettler, a writer from South Dakota who self-published a book about hunting. Can you tell us a little bit about his case and how it ties into Page Turner that I mentioned a few minutes ago?
Yeah. Poor Mr. Dettler. Basically, you know, he had self-published this book years ago, and sort of out of the blue, someone from Page Turner came to him and said, "You know, I found your book, and I really think it could sell a lot better than it had in the past. So, you know, we can do marketing, we can put ads in Publisher Weekly and all these other magazines." And basically, this agent lured Kevin in with these ridiculously high priced services. I mean, he was paying upwards of $100,000 per single service, and he ended up spending over $500,000 with Page Turner and got absolutely nothing out of it.
Mm. So tell us about Page Turner, the company. What led to the U.S. Justice Department getting involved? Is the company as a whole, was it always a bad seed?
Yes, very much. So the company was based in this city in the Philippines called Cebu, which is the third largest city in the Philippines. And it operated, it was a legitimate company and had dozens of employees, but really it was just one giant scam. And the way it worked, it would lure in writers, mostly British and American writers, like Kevin Dettler, and it would lure them in with legitimate self-publishing services like marketing and editing, and then it would hit them with the fraud, which was, hey, Netflix wants to turn your book into a movie or a TV series, and they're going to pay you $7 million to do it. Mm. But you need to pay X, Y, and Z before that can happen. And that really was the essence of the scam and of their company.
So do you know why Mr. Dettler kept forking over money, even though he said he knew he shouldn't have? I mean, he ended up, you know, with, you said it was $500,000 that he lost. How did it keep happening to him?
Yeah, I mean, his story was really indicative of the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of victims of Page Turner, which is that Page Turner, they put on what one victim described to me as the terror tactics. So they constantly hound writers. They're calling them, they're texting them, and they're saying, you need to do this now. You need to sign this contract now, or this deal's, you know, going to disappear, and this could change your life. And Yeah, they really just exploit that vulnerability that all sort of writers have, which is that need for affirmation, that need to find success for people to read your book. So at the same time that they're putting on the terror tactics, they're also sort of blowing smoke and saying you're a really great talent, you're a once in a generation talent. So that's really how they do it.
The Justice Department press release about this, where the 800 writers were conned out of millions of dollars, referred to they called these 800 writers, quote, elderly authors. Can you tell us more about that? Were they singled out rather for their age?
Definitely. I mean, it's not the case that 100% of the victims of these types of scams are elderly, but a lot of them tend to be. There's a few reasons for that. I mean, a lot of the books that are being self-published are memoirs. Certainly not all of them, but a lot of the victims I talked to had memoirs, and these are books that the writers sort of saw as their legacy. And they really just wanted it to get published and read no matter what. And a lot of these people are sitting on savings and retirement money. And then also, older people tend not to be as savvy on the internet. And they're sending them these fake contracts and using these fake email addresses. And so that, going after older people was really their MO.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about authors who want to get published and the rise in author scams with freelance investigative reporter Brent Crane. Your article also quoted Cheryl Douglas, general counsel for the Authors Guild, saying that scamming of writers has gone through the roof. The five big publishing companies, which is Hatchet Book Group, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin Random House, and Simon and Schuster, all five of those have issued public warnings about scammers in recent years. So, what is driving this rise in scams? How did someone one day figure out, books, that's where I'll get them?
Yeah, I mean, it's really we're really living in the age of scams, and it's sort of not a mystery why, right? It's the internet. It's how easy it is to access individuals, to hound individuals, and to sort of pretend you're somebody else. And so the book publishing scam is just one sort of type of scam, which is, there's a million types of different scams on the internet, but the difference is that, as I said before, publishers are sort of uniquely, I mean, sorry, writers are sort of uniquely vulnerable in that, me as a writer, we really need that affirmation. We really seek that out. We put our heart and soul into our writing, into our books, and the scammers know that, and they really exploit that.
Three executives related to Paige Turner pleaded not guilty. Is Paige Turner still around? Is there any response from them?
Yeah, they've all pleaded not guilty, as you said, and they've sort of officially blamed it on a handful of what they call rogue sales agents. And they claim that, sort of ludicrously, only nine writers had been scammed. But I mean, I was easily able to find, dozens of writers who had been scammed by Paige Turner. And so yeah, they're denying it. The court, the proceedings haven't started. They're still in discovery. So we'll see where the case goes.
Have you looked into any other similar investigations, or is Paige Turner the one that you've mainly focused on?
Yeah, Paige Turner is the one I focus on for this piece. There was a case out of Oklahoma where there was a significant conviction that came to pass, and the people running that scam are now in prison. But we'll see what happens here. I mean, this all happened sort of in the Philippines, so.
Yeah, you mentioned the Philippines. Why did that become a hub for this?
Yeah, well, that's really what got me interested in this story, because once you start looking into this, you realize that all of these scams, or a huge percentage of them, are based in this one city in the Philippines, and there's a reason for that, which is this company called Author Solutions, which is an American, really big self-publishing company, and they own a bunch of these so-called imprints, and they had outsourced their operations to Cebu in 2009. And so a lot of these scam companies are started by people who had worked at this legitimate company, Author Solutions, and just sort of took those skills and went full scammer.
Interesting. Well, can you tell me more about Author Solutions? Because I read in your story that it was recently purchased from Center Street Ventures, which is an Ohio investment firm. So there is an Ohio connection here. I mean, we sit here in Columbus. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, they've sort of had several owners over the years. And, you know, I want to stress here that they are a legitimate company, but they've had a lot of accusations of sort of predatory sales practices. There's been two class action lawsuits against them. One was settled out of court and one was dismissed. But a lot of writers are very unsatisfied with Author Solutions, should we say. They accuse them of upselling them, ridiculously priced services, and sort of not fully delivering. But you know, the real scamming is happening with these sort of upstart scam companies like Page Turner.
Now, when you were reporting this story, you ended up getting involved in the story you were reporting on, and you ended up getting threatened. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of a convoluted story, but just to sum it up quickly, I'm reaching out to former employees of Page Turner, and most people are sort of ignoring me or not wanting to talk to me. But one guy did want to talk to me. His name is Mike Gorn. He was one of the early, what they called sales agents at Page Turner, but, you know, the better word is scammer. And, you know, he was very open talking to me before I went to Cebu. And when I went to Cebu, I meet him in person. And we have an interview for, like, you know, 3 hours or so in a cafe. And then he says, oh, I have all these documents from Page Turner, but I can't send them over email. I have to deliver them to you in person. And so, you know, I thought my alarm bells are ringing, but my sort of local fixer I'm working with thought it could be legit. And so the next day we ended up meeting him. And yeah, long story short, he didn't have these documents. And it actually got a little hairy, you know, once I sort of started to pull the plug and leave the situation, he basically chased us through this mall. And we had to, we really had to hightail it out of there.
Was he trying to get you to pay him to give you fake documents, basically?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure exactly what his game plan was, but he was somehow trying to get money out of us, obviously.
Once a scammer, always a scammer, I guess, is for that guy.
but if you read the story, you know, there's a lot of great quotes from him in the story. So yeah. Maybe worth it in the end.
Yeah. So from your reporting on Page Turner, did anyone eventually didn't get their money back at all? Or is this all just lost money?
Yeah, I only found one man who was able to get his money back. We used a pseudonym for him in the story because he was very afraid of retaliation from these people. I mean, he's really traumatized by this experience, but he was able to hire a lawyer in the Philippines who somehow was able to get Page Turner to cough up over $100,000 of the money he had lost. So he didn't get all of the money that he had lost, but he got some.
What do you think from your reporting on Page Turner? What do you think this case from the Justice Department could mean for the broader publishing industry? Do you think there's lessons learned for the publishing industry?
I think it's less lessons for the publishing industry and more for, you know, individual would-be victims. I mean, just the more we can get the word out on these scams, the better. You know, the more suspicion writers can have when they get calls and emails out of the blue, the better. You know, one thing I would really just stress is for when you get a call or an email from one of these scammers, ask to do a video call with them. Because one thing a lot of the victims told me is that none of the scammers would do video calls. So that could be a good way to just sort of, you know, suss out the playing field.
Look the person in the eye. You can maybe tell better if they're lying.
Tell better if they're lying, but also if they'll do the video call or not.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them just flat out won't do it. They come up with excuses as to why they can't do it.
Interesting. All right. Well, Brent Crane is an investigative reporter, and he wrote the article for Bloomberg Business Week titled, "Our Goal is to Get Their Money: Inside a Firm Charged with Scamming Writers for Millions." Brent, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk to the president of Ohio Writers Association. It's a group that helps guide writers through the writing and publishing process. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Writing a book is hard, but getting it published may be even harder. The publishing landscape can be especially rocky terrain for new authors, self-published writers, and the legions out there who are not household names. The hope of getting your book published is also giving rise to author scams, too. Joe Graves is a published author and president of the Ohio Writers Association, a nonprofit that supports professional writers and emerging authors. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Yeah, so good to be here.
So in the previous segment, we talked about an investigative reporter who wrote about U.S. Justice Department charging three executives at Page Turner for defrauding more than 800 million, for allegedly defrauding more than 800 authors out of $44 million. I mean, that case obviously is huge, but what is your sense of author scams? Do you feel like it is a growing problem that people need to be aware of?
Well, I think the technology and the ability to trick people into anything is increasingly a problem. But, you know, especially with authors, there's nothing better than writing something and wanting to get it out into the world. I mean, and when you write something that's different than like other genres, I was thinking about like musicians, and they write a song and maybe someday it becomes a hit, but they're probably playing it in bars and in other places, and they get to try it out and they get to tweak it. With an author in the publishing world, you can share it privately to get feedback, but if you put it in any sort of public marketplace, a blog or whatever, the likelihood that a publisher will want it goes down. And so that's part of what's being leveraged in the scams is, I want this out there, and until I publish it or decide how I'm going to publish it, I really can't share it publicly. I can share it with readers privately to get feedback, but it's really not there to be consumed until it gets published. And so there's a desire for that. And we try to encourage ours. We've done workshops and stuff around publishing. And essentially there's three okay ways to be published. You can self-publish, and it's really not complicated. Companies have made it very easy with print on demand to publish yourself. You can hybrid publish, which is paying a publisher to publish you. And there's a lot of great businesses that do that, and they do it well. And they do it without scamming people. And then you can traditionally publish, which means you're not paying or you're getting paid, you know, to publish. But avoiding the scams is important in the process, because even just in preparing for this interview, I ended up getting hundreds of ads on my social media.
Just because you Googled it?
Just because I Googled it. Just because I was, you know, looking into it or, you know, talking about it. And yeah, I get all these ads on social media for, you know, whenever there's a publisher saying, please submit, they most likely want to charge you.
Yeah.
That's the reality. Because publishers that aren't charging you usually have very small windows for open submissions.
Well, how do you tell people that they can distinguish a legitimate publisher from one that might be a scam, especially for that hybrid model you talked about where you're paying someone to publish your book? How do you know if it's legitimate?
Well, I mean, the easiest way is if you're paying for something, to be very clear what you're paying for, and does it meet market rates? The average cost for publishing a book, self-publishing a book, is going to be between $3,000 and $5,000, depending on what you're trying to do. I think authors, publishers, and creatives should be paid. And so if you're going to ask someone to design your book cover, they should be compensated. If you're asking someone to provide developmental editing or copy editing, all of those services should be paid. But on average right now, $3,000 to $5,000 is going to cost you to do that. And if there's a company that's charging you more than that, mm-hmm. and they're not even doing a good job on your cover design, your copy editing, you know, then obviously there's something else going on. Or, you know, these false promises that people make that they're going to sell X number of copies, they're going to get you in front of certain things. I mean, these are just not reality. Whether you're traditionally published or use a hybrid publishing or you self-publish and you contract some of the work out to, you know, you pay someone to do your cover design and you put it all together, regardless of those platforms, everyone is relying on the author to market their books. Mm. Even traditional publishers, they want to know, how many social media followers do you have? What's your email list? What's your platform? Who's your audience? So if there's a company out there that's promising you something that a traditional publisher can't even promise you, because a traditional publisher isn't going to necessarily take a risk on somebody who has zero audience, mm-hmm. but then a company's like, pay us $10,000 and we'll sell you 1 million copies. I mean, they're making promises that nobody can fulfill. And so then you know it's a scam.
We did hear from one author, not from Ohio, who ran into an issue with a publisher. It's not a part of a scam, but money was not paid as promised. Audiobook narration was not compensated. What can authors do if they have a problem with their publisher and there's a contract involved? Have you ever talked with someone about authors having problems with publishers?
You know, publishing contracts can be very complicated. Mm-hmm. And we, as the Ohio Writers Association, we publish anthologies about every other year, and we're purchasing the short stories or poems from people, and we have contracts involved. And so as the president, I've had to navigate some of those conversations, like, what does this mean? Why? And I'm not a lawyer, and I know contracts as well as an author would know. So our organization usually consults a literary agent slash a lawyer that we work with, especially when crafting contracts. But if you're an author, you know, you need to know what you're signing, mm-hmm. because it can be very complicated, and there could be stuff in the small print that you don't understand or how it works. And so the best advice, of course, in any of these situations is to seek legal advice or to read the small print carefully to know what it means and to look up the words, because they use terms like first rights or first U.S. rights and things like that. And if you don't know what those mean, then you need to, you know, educate yourself.
Do you feel like there's sometimes a power imbalance between an author and a publisher where the author feels like they have to do what the publisher says?
You know, the publishing industry is historically hard to navigate, mm-hmm. you know, and even having been published or walking with people to be published, I think there can be absolutely a power imbalance. But like in all of society, we have to learn to advocate for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so we have to say, okay, we have to overcome that overwhelming desire as an author to get our stuff out there, because that's such a powerful force that can be manipulated. I want my stuff published so bad. We have to manage that and then walk forward carefully. Mm-hmm. You know, as I talk with our members, they all create healthy boundaries for themselves. I have a lot of members in our group that'll say, if they ask for any money, I'm not interested. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to work with a publisher who's going to charge me. That's a boundary they've set. Others said, I found a publisher that I pay to publish my work. Here's why I think it's great. It works for me. I've been very happy with it. And then, of course, others will say, I know myself who've been taken advantage of. And so the author has to set their own boundaries in what they hope to accomplish in their writing. One of those can be, I'm not going to ever pay someone to publish. And other, it becomes more complicated if you're saying, yeah, I will pay someone. I just want to make sure that it's good. There's an alliance of independent authors that actually, when you become a member, provides a list of sort of vetted services. Mm. And to become a partner in their list, you have to agree to things like clarity and integrity and not spamming people or adding, constantly pressuring people to upsell. And lists like that provide people with cover designers and editors and copy editors and people who can do book format at market rates. And they're going to do a good job, and they're going to treat the author like a customer that deserves mm-hmm. respect.
We're talking about the competitive and often confusing publishing industry, especially for an author who is new to the process. And we're talking with Joe Graves, who is a published author and the president of the Ohio Writers Association. That's a nonprofit that supports professional writers and emerging authors. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Do you understand whenever you talk about contracts? I know you say you're not a lawyer, so you understand it as much as a writer does. But do you understand the intellectual property part of once a contract is signed, who owns the words?
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, and every contract's going to be different. Mm-hmm. So what I'll speak from our own experience, and this is the case for a lot of small publications in the fiction world. They'll want first rights. So, and I'm speaking in broad strokes, but that means we don't want something that's been published elsewhere, generally speaking, but you still own it and you can publish it elsewhere. But when we publish it in our anthology or on our website, we're going to be the first to publish it. And so we own those first rights. And so you can go get a deal with Netflix if you want, but Netflix can't tell us to take it down. Mm. If that makes sense.
I see.
And so that's, so in that sense, intellectual property then really kind of still belongs with the author. We've just contracted with the author to be able to, you know, publish it and, you know, moving forward, regardless of what they do with it in the future. That's fairily common in smaller fiction press. And that's the language that I'm most familiar with. Of course, it can change throughout. Mm. And I will say that those who self-publish, based on some surveys that the Alliance of Independent Authors has done, the biggest reason they self-publish is to be able to control what happens mm-hmm. with their book. And so there is a desire in self-publishing to have that, to be sure that you own this moving forward.
So if you self-publish and you pay that $3,000 to $5,000 to produce X many of your books, and then you decide to shop it around to a bigger publisher, will they not want it because it's already been published, or do they not count self-publishing?
Yeah, no, the best advice, and every publisher is different, but the best advice I can give for authors is if you put it out on any platform that can be accessed publicly, whether you take it down or not, it becomes less desirable to a publisher. Mm. Generally speaking, every publisher is different. I'm sure there's cases where somebody self-published something and it did so well, a publisher wanted to get in on that ride. But for the most part, because everything is so competitive, if you self-publish or you publish on your blog and then try to shop it to publishers, it's just going to hurt your chances. And that is a challenge, like I said at the beginning, because you want your stuff out there and you really can't have it out there publicly until you find a way to publish it. So if you're holding off on a traditional publisher, you know, you could be holding mm-hmm. on to a novel that only a few people have read for years.
Yeah. I could imagine also if you make it an ebook, that could be even worse because then it's digital and it can go anywhere.
No, absolutely. And those prices that I mentioned earlier, I believe that those are just for setting the book up. That wouldn't even necessarily include copies. Mm. So nowadays, if you're working, that piece of advice I'd give as well, if you're working with a hybrid publisher or what some might call a vanity press, and part of that package is purchasing 1,000 copies, I also would probably discourage that. Print on demand is so readily accessible, and there's lots of companies that do it. And what that means is your book would be uploaded to their server, and they do it reputably. This is how Amazon works, this is how Ingram Spark, and there's others. It's uploaded to their server, and when someone buys it on whatever platform it's listed on, it gets printed and shipped to them.
So one-to-one instead of
one-to-one.
Having 1,000 books sitting in your basement.
And when you purchase those 1,000 books and they probably oversold it on you, now you're stuck with these books. And that works, and that's how people used to self-publish before print-on-demand was an option. Mm. And it worked fine if you are a person who tables at a lot of fairs. But if you don't have a way to sell physical copies of your book, like you're not going every weekend to a book fair to meet potential readers, it's just better to go print on demand. And then with print on demand, then you can go in and you can order copies at a discounted price anyway. So you still have that option.
How do you feel in recent years social media has played an influence on publishing? That ability you mentioned earlier that you have to have an audience for someone to be interested in you. So you have to already have a following.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Is that
you? I mean, I would say that it's, if not number one, in the top three things a publisher is going to be looking for is what your audience. And by audience, that could be speaking engagements. It could be email lists, but most likely it's the number of followers. I mean, most publishers that I'm interacting with that I might be submitting to, they're asking for the number of followers that you have. And I think it's huge because that's how books are getting to the hands of readers nowadays, is by the author having their own audience that they can market to. And, you know, if you have less than 5,000, it's tough. And I mean, I would say that the big five publishers, they're looking for the friends that I have who are influencers, who get published by the big five publishers, the traditional publishers. The lowest one that I know is 30,000 followers on Instagram. Another guy who I know is getting published with 300,000 followers on Instagram. So if you're not engaged in social media and you're not building an audience, I think it is much more difficult to get a publisher's attention.
And what about the growth in audiobooks versus ebooks and hardcovers? One of the biggest audiobook companies is Dreamscape. They're right here in Ohio. Do you have, as a part of your writers group, do you talk about audiobooks too?
Oh yeah, we love audiobooks. In fact, we've worked with an organization that's sadly no longer around, partly because of the advancements in AI as it's impacted the audiobook world. But it was the Audiobook Narrators of Ohio, Ohio Audiobook Narrators. And it was a small group of audiobook narrators who did this professionally. And we partnered with them for about three of our anthologies. So we'd have a print, an ebook, and an audiobook. So those audiobooks are hosted by Dreamscape. And we've had, you know, a relatively fine experience. I don't have any complaints, but our books are still up there where people can listen to them. And I think I actually just saw recently Columbus Library posted that for the first time in the history of the library, more people checked out audiobooks than ebooks.
I saw that,
and that
too.
That threshold shifted.
Yeah.
And so absolutely we are moving towards consuming things. People live increasingly busy lives. And so we want to be able to listen while we're doing the dishes, listen while we're walking, listen while we're stuck in traffic. And you can do that with an audiobook. So the potential for audiobooks are huge. My one traditional published book that I have so far doesn't have an audiobook, and it's something that people request often. It's like, hey, when are you going to have the audiobook? Well, it's complicated, but we'll get there.
Will you get there? That's what I was going
to
ask. Yeah,
I hope to.
Yeah. Well, as someone who works on the radio, and this show is a podcast as well, I have to be a fan of audiobooks. You know, you want people to listen while they're doing the dishes, while they're cleaning the house. Multitasking is how it is now. We have about 1 minute left. What is your best advice for a writer who's listening right now, who has their life's work on their computer and they just want someone to read it?
Well, I would say the best advice that I give any writer, separate from publishing, is to find people who can give you honest feedback. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of feedback is people will read it. That's one of the main things our organization does, is provides opportunities for people to receive peer critique, peer feedback. And there's nothing more beautiful than those first few people reading it. It can be painful because they have hard things to say, but it's the best thing you can do. If you ever want to get published, the road to being published is editing and feedback, and incorporating that and making your writing the best it can be.
Thank you to Joe Graves, a published author and the president of the Ohio Writers Association. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to be here.
And up next, we're going to talk with $2 Radio, a local indie publisher, about how they regard authors. Stay with us for more All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about authors and the publishing industry. Our state has a robust roster of Ohio authors and author wannabes. As we've heard earlier in the show, the publishing industry is changing, and there are more ways to get your work in front of readers. But scammers are also on the rise. We just heard from the Ohio Writers Association, which helps writers get published. Now we're bringing into the conversation a local indie publisher. Eric Obanoff is the co-founder and editorial director of $2 Radio, which celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. $2 Radio's titles have won honors from the National Book Foundation, been finalists for the Carnegie Medal for Excellence, and other coveted awards. Welcome to All Sides, Eric.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So $2 Radio may be better known to some of our listeners as a bookstore and a cafe on Parsons Avenue, but you publish books too. How would you define your mission? Because your website uses words like, our work is for the adventurous and independent spirits. So what is your mission?
Well, I don't think it benefits an independent publisher to publish books that could just as easily be published by a large multinational corporation. And so as an independent publisher, you have an opportunity to really craft, you know, what one might consider a brand, but really just comes down to like distinctive tastes of those involved in the publishing process. And because there's fewer people involved, a lot of times, if you like one of the books that an indie press puts out, you'll most likely appreciate a lot of them. But what the sort of shorthand I give for the books that we like to work on are bold literary fiction. Our tagline is books too loud to ignore. And then we also do topical contemporary nonfiction, several essay collections we've published.
Yeah, I was looking at the notable authors that you have published. One name that stood out to me is Hanif Abdurraqib. Is he one of your more famous names that you have on your list?
He is, yeah. I mean, we published They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, which was his like debut essay collection. And it really just, you know, it really took off. At this point, I think we've got around 100,000, just over 100,000 copies in print. But then, you know, we never could have anticipated that Hanif would, you know, blow up to become obviously like the household name that he is and everything like that. So he's gone on to enjoy great success. But some other writers that we've published are Billy Ray Belcourt, who's Canada's first First Nations Rhodes Scholar, and also the youngest ever winner of the Griffin Prize for Poetry. And then several like fiction writers that we've published, Nora Lang, who last year, we just published her debut novel, Us Fools, in September of 2024. And the New York Times called it the Great American Novel. And it was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction and a Los Angeles Times bestseller.
Do you get a lot of authors sending you work hoping they fit into your brand the way you just described your brand? You have to probably curate to select the ones that do fit in with what you're looking for.
Yeah, we do get a lot of submissions, and in any given year we're probably publishing 6 or 7 original titles, half of which are agented submissions. So we do work with some of the big New York City agents. And then the other half are unsolicited. And a lot of our best-selling titles have come to us unsolicited, including I Will Die in a Foreign Land by Kalani Pickhart, which won the New York Public Library's Young Lions Fiction Award. And we released it in the fall just before Russia invaded Ukraine. And that novel dealt with the Euromaidan protests in Ukraine over the winter of 2013 to 2014. And so it was incredibly timely in terms of providing a cultural context for the Russia invasion and everything that's happened since.
How would you say that you can prioritize, you know, if you get something submitted to you from an agent and you trust the agent, then you probably know, like, yes, this is worth my time to read. But all of these like cold call ones where people are just like mailing you their life's work, how do you know what to pick? Can you tell within the first few pages?
Yeah, probably. But also we have a little cheat question that we include in our, we use a platform called Submittable that authors can submit to us through. And one of the form questions that we have is, why do you think $2 Radio is the perfect home for your work? Mm-hmm. And so that is a really good question just for like cutting through the red tape to like see whether this author is familiar with any of the other works we publish. and how they see it fitting in with the rest of those titles, like why it would be a good fit. So, you know, if someone says, I just like the name of your company, then, you know, that might mean that they didn't put their research into submitting, and they're just kind of maybe carpet bombing with their manuscript anyone with a public email address. And I do think is like the best advice that I give to writers is, you know, it's like if aspiring writers, you have to treat it seriously and, you know, consider it like a job too. You have to do research into the agents that you submit your work to and the publishers too, for why they would be a good fit. Because as an editor or an agent, you don't necessarily want to feel like someone is just wasting your time. And that little bit of familiarity goes a long way.
Earlier in the hour, we talked about a rise in author scams. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating Page Turner Press. Three individuals face charges of allegedly cheating 800 authors out of $44 million. Now, I know author scams is not a topic that you know a ton about, but $2 Radio has a reputation for being supportive and above board with its authors. So how do you work to make sure that authors are supported and fairly compensated?
Well, I mean, it starts with our just like boilerplate publishing agreement. And then from there, the entire publishing process is very collaborative. So we're very hands-on in working with our authors, giving them, you know, say over cover design, layout, you know, final revisions to the manuscript. But I think that, you know, before we ever sign any agreement, we typically have a phone conversation with the author and we just outline where we see the book fitting in with our list, how we plan on promoting it, stuff like that. And I think that, especially when you're working with a small business, that sort of like personalization like sets you kind of over the edge, because, you know, if you work with a multinational corporation, say you get an offer from Penguin Random House, you're going to be shuffled down the line from the editor to the sales department to someone who's booking an author tour and everything like that to someone else doing the cover design. And you really have to depend on this idea that they are, that everyone down that line is going to be as equally passionate about your work as that initial person who took it on. So that level of just that personal touch, I think, is something that sets us apart as an indie press in terms of working with our authors.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about book publishing this hour, and right now we're talking with Eric Obanoff, publisher at $2 Radio. You mentioned a standard boilerplate contract. Is there one contract you use for most authors, or are there certain someone who's established with you? Maybe do they get a different type of contract, or is every contract different, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, they all have their little quirks. So, you know, after years of, you know, working with one author agency in particular, you know, we have adapted our boilerplate to, you know, for them to be satisfied with the agreement, and a different agency might have different little caveats in their publishing agreement. But for the most part, it's all there, and we're, you know, calculating royalties the same. Some things that might change might be the sub-licensing rights. So as much as possible, you know, we've been doing this, like you said, for 20 years. And so we have a network of agents internationally who are working to sell rights for us, you know, in Europe, Asia, South America. And, you know, so if you're an author on your own and you're not working with an agent, then you might not have those connections. And so if we take a small percentage of those sales from that income, and then the exchange is, so we're essentially acting like an agency in this case. And then our co-agents are then trying to sell the Portuguese rights, the Brazilian Portuguese, the Portuguese rights, the Italian rights. And then we have a management company in LA that we work with as well. But all that stuff is really laid out in the very initial agreement that we signed with the authors.
In April, I read that $2 Radio became an imprint of Seven Stories Press. Can you tell me about that change? What does it mean to become an imprint?
Well, so Seven Stories is a very storied publisher. They've published like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky, Octavia Butler, Nobel Prize winner Annie Ernaux, Nelson Algren. And so, yeah, they've been around for a bunch of years. They're based in New York. And the person who started the press, Dan Simon, has been a friend and ally and mentor as we were starting out. Because when we started as a publishing company, we didn't have any experience in the industry. And so in terms of coming on underneath Seven Stories and what an imprint does is, you know, we operate fairly autonomously. But then we share some staff too, like in terms of publicity and marketing. And so for us, I think it really broadens the umbrella of like what we can cover ourselves. So as an example, our titles through this arrangement, they have someone who works specifically on library marketing and outreach. And that was, you know, an entire facet of the bookselling industry that we didn't necessarily pursue that much on our own. And now our titles and our authors are represented to the libraries through Seven Stories staff member.
Hmm. Do you feel any pressure as an indie publisher from things that have popped up in recent years where people can self-publish and try to sell it themselves on Amazon and that kind of thing? Do you feel pressure in your business?
No. Because we have this very, I mean, at this point, there's an entire network of booksellers across the country, you know, who are very supportive of our work. We know that we're good at what we do, that we can get the book out into the world. I think it really comes down to, you know, why you're wanting to publish a book in the first place. And if you want to publish a book where people will read it, and it will be carried in stores, bookstores, then the route to take is to definitely go through a traditional book publishing company, because you already have this entire distribution network. You know, you have the contacts to get the book in front of the right people, the review editors, the booksellers, Barnes & Noble. And if you're trying to do all that stuff on your own, using some like pay-to-play model, then the book just won't get out there. I mean, you might be able to sell a couple hundred copies to like charitable family and friends, but you don't have that support network.
Audiobooks are becoming more and more popular. Does $2 Radio work with authors on audiobooks and narration?
We've released two audiobooks ourselves, but for the most part, we sublicense audiobooks to those publishers. They have, you know, narrators that they work with on a regular basis, and audiobooks can also be, I mean, to print a book, you know, it could be anywhere from like $5,000 to $15,000 for the first printing. And you know, I imagine an audiobook would be around $5,000 to produce too. And so that's just the added income. So for the most part, the route that we take as a publisher is we try to sublicense those rights to audiobook publishers.
I probably should have asked you at the very beginning, and I didn't. Why is your name? Why is your name $2 Radio?
So, well, when we were just hashing the idea of starting a book publishing company, I was bartending. We were living in San Diego, and there's a drunk guy that I was not serving, and he said, "Don't mind me, I make more noise than a $2 radio." So I just like the sound of it. And our tagline is "Books too loud to ignore."
Oh, that's nice. See, as a person who works in radio, I've found myself compelled. I was like, I should have asked him right off the beginning why radio in the title. But there you go. Well, just as a final question to end, what advice would you give to an Ohio writer who is looking to get published? And you know, maybe they're interested in a company like yours, or maybe they're, you know, looking somewhere else. But what would your advice be to a writer who thinks they have something good and just don't know what to do with it?
Well, just be a reader. And, you know, so if you have a writer that you or a novel that you think is like comparable to the work that you're writing, then, you know, flip through the back, try to find out who that author's agent is, get in touch with the agent, say, you know, like, because you admire such and such writer, I hope that my work, you know, is in the spirit of their work, and I hope that you might enjoy it as well. And same, take the same approach with publishers. Just, you know, if you're curious about an independent publisher, then read some of their work, see if it'll be a good fit. I mean, our books, we're not that perfect home as a publisher for every writer's work. You know, we don't do kids book. We don't do a lot of nonfiction. We don't do much memoir. So, you know, really it's just, if you're a writer, just being a reader first and putting in that little bit of legwork yourself before you go about submitting to people.
We've been talking with Eric Obanoff. He's co-founder and editorial director of $2 Radio, which is celebrating 20 years this year. Thank you so much for your time, Eric.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.